Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Into the Darkness. I am Pam Ray, a poet on a website called All Poetry with a group of poets called Late Night Poets. You don't have to belong to the group or the website to call in, to share, to listen and enjoy, but it is highly recommended. Now tonight is our dark poetry night. It is also an after midnight show, which means while we do not allow for smut porn or overly graphic violence, we do allow for a bit more adult content. If neither of those are your cup of tea, please check out our other shows. We have up to 2 shows per night on a variety of styles of topics and poetry, something to suit everyone's taste. Also, make sure when you get a chance to go to Amazon and check out the poetry anthologies put out by Late Night Poets, because when you purchase those, you not only get amazing poetry, you help support these radio shows. Now, for tonight's show, I ran a contest on All Poetry with poems by Robert Frost. Because I wanted people to delve into and to take a look and be inspired by the darker side of Robert Frost's poetry. Many people think of his poetry as almost pastoral in nature, reflecting on rural life and reflecting on nature itself. And he does have that, but he also has poetry that delves into the darkness of death and fear and loss. And so we chose four prompts and poems and, you know, ask people to just be inspired. And the contest filled up. We got a full topic board tonight of just wonderful dark poetry. And it's always intriguing to me how people can take and be inspired by the same prompt in different ways. And, of course, to open the show, I would like to go ahead and post and read one of Robert Frost's poems that was one of the prompts in the contest. And so with that being said, this is To Earthward by Robert Frost. And it goes like this. Love at the lips was touch, as sweet as I could bear. And once that seemed too much, I lived on air. That crossed me from sweet things, the flow of was it musk from hidden grapevine springs. Downhill at dusk, I had the swirl and ache from sprays of honeysuckle that when they're gathered shake dew on the knuckle. I crave strong sweets, but those seemed strong when I was young. The petal of the rose, it was that stung. Now no joy but lacks salt that is not dashed with pain. And weariness and fault, I crave the stain of tears, the aftermark of almost too much love, the sweet of bitter bark and burning clove. When stiff and sore and scarred, I take away my hand from leaning on it hard in grass and sand. The hurt is not enough. I long for weight and strength to feel the earth as rough to all my length. End poem. Now, I admit I was hoping for a male voice to read that poem. I think it would have been better suited for a male voice, but I am what you got. And, you know, the thing with that, right, is there is a kind of there's a sensuality to it. It's a very layered right, which seems to be something, you know, in Robert Frost's poetry, is that his language is deceptively simple while the rights are layered. And I feel like at the same time, I feel like there's a sadness, a mourning, like for life and as it comes to the end, to a point where we'll be buried beneath the earth, but also this, how it talks, I believe, in my opinion, about the pain of loving someone with all your heart, of losing that somebody. And, you know, as I mentioned, there is a certain kind of sensuality that connects, you know, people and earth and nature within this rite. And there's kind of this almost like this longing for death, like the end of life is near, and this readiness to be buried beneath the earth. At least that's what I got from it. And you know, and of course, I know most people know Robert Frost's poetry, without a doubt. And, you know, and of course, you know, those who don't, you know, I highly recommend that you check him out. He is just an amazing classic poet. Of course, all poetry is a great place for not only meeting current poets, but also like-minded individuals, but also, you know, getting an introduction to those classic poets and their styles. And I'm going to go ahead and post a poem, Erstwhile, by Eric Svensson. And this one has a SoundCloud and recording, so I'm going to go ahead and push play.
Erstwhile, your yank of chain, inevitable as defecation needs to be flushed away. Ice cold, white porcelain vestibule stands aloof, unaffected by pain. Callous consul not in the business of consoling. Condolences grew dimly thin, nor of last fall days. Lucid leaves drop, give up the ghost in florid flush. Death rattle of russet reds, brocaded lace handkerchief drops, hickory wood coffin indifferent. Erstwhile, contemplation cavalcades rolled in, pregnant sky belly bulged, squatted over filigree full effluorage, like threadbare banting flags at a fair. Town square bandstand marooned, empty, conductor winter's baton quivered. Kindness from kestrel eyes, clear white porcelain flecks surrounded the iris. Head cocked to side, the bird commiserates. Peculiar light emanates from its eyes, as if such a creature comprehends the death of a mate. Confirmation comes in high-pitched clee-killy notes. Your yank of realization's chain, inevitable as defecation needs be flushed away. Would a spring death have lessened separation's pain? Kind kestrel responds with a long, low-key whine. First, tentative snowflakes make their presence known. Dandelion dance of a last breath flutter. White porcelain hand, ice cold. High-pitched kestrel clee-killy again. Remember her peaceful face, crimson crush as you kissed her kind lips. End poem.
Wonderful read and write there, Eric. Thank you for the SoundCloud. It is very much appreciated. And just a reminder, everyone, if you cannot call into the shows, but you can make a recording, that is the next best thing, because then we can hear your poetry in your voice. And before I comment on this poem, I'd like to welcome Afaziana to this show. Welcome, Afaziana. I'm so glad you could be here.
Hi, Pam. Glad to be here, too.
Yeah, I don't know what happened to my co-host, whether he's in a deep sleep because he's exhausted or something's going on with his phone, but he just was not answering, and so he's not here tonight, and yeah, which is fine, but it also just meant that, you know, I was, as you can tell, desperately looking for somebody, so I'm glad you called.
Well, I'm here.
Awesome sauce. I really like how this has a subtle darkness to it. I like how, like Robert Frost, he uses nature, and especially the bird. And what I like is that he shows the connection between the bird and the person. The bird, a kendril or something like that, kestrel. The kind kestrel responds with a long, low-key whine. And I like that he says a long, low-key whine, because I think what it shows us is that birds aren't, you know, they don't all make the same sound. They all have their unique sound used for individual reasons. And I like lucid leaves drop, give up the ghost, and floor flush, death rattle of russet reds. I like how you can use that line there for kind of a symbology, a metaphor for nearing the end of life. And I also really like remember her peaceful face, crimson crush as he kissed her kind lips. I just think, you know, as always, he has stunning imagery and metaphors, and it's very well done. And do you feel like you could comment on this piece of Aviana?
Yes, I didn't get to hear it, but I have been reading while you were commenting, and I think it's really incredible how he uses the bird to bring this all to life. Great choice of descriptions here, and he really creates a mood from the very beginning. Inevitable as defecation needs to be flushed away. I mean, you're starting off with kind of that dark feel of, like, you're talking about the shit needs to be flushed away, and that really sets the tone for it. But then it also has this, like, beautiful description of the bird. I like pregnant sky belly bulged, because they do have that kind of, like, blue bulge of the belly, but also it feels like it's full of potential when you say the pregnant sky. Just the wording, like, peculiar light emanates from its eyes. I've always liked the word emanates. Great descriptions. Yeah, like porcelain, to describe the color, it's not just white. Porcelain really adds so much to it. Wonderful, wonderful word choices.
Absolutely, absolutely. That was very well said, and you're right. Great word choices. All right, so I just got a message from my co-host. He apparently woke up and is in the land of the living. So what I'm going to do, because he actually has to be called in, is I'm going to have you read Night Fears by Yorkie Buff, and then if you don't mind, just go ahead and go straight into commenting.
Sure. Night Fears by Yorkie Buff. Dead leaves sigh inside dark branches that cleft then clutch at frosted panes, brushing against nursery bars. Stiff fingers make bone taps dried into bark strength by scarred whistled winds, seeking space to spread feathers, suffocating pinched noses covered by a knitted blanket rim as eyes stare held in fear of wings slithering over skin. The window remains reflecting safely in nightlight, flickers as cruel claws span over slate nightmare landscapes. Tired lids close fluttering, stuttering into bleak shadows, dusty plumage swoops, then settles on pale breath sobbing. Even as glass shatters onto linoleum, in shrouded silence a dark dream hovers, driven by avian fiends from hell. End poem. Wow, I really enjoyed this. I mean, I love owls, and I love the dark imagery here. It really has that kind of sinister tone, and yet again, the beauty of the birds. There's kind of a creepiness about the way that it is sort of outside the window, and there's something about the light flickering and the claws described there that really creates that sense of, like, when you when you're in the dark and you look out the window and there's that tree branch that kind of like goes up against it and makes a creepy noise, and then you look and there's the owl's eyes, there's kind of a suspense feeling going on there. But I really love the way that it describes the owl itself, knitted blanket rim, because they have that kind of way that the feathers go around the eyes, where it's like they have a hood. And then to describe with inner rhymes, fluttering, stuttering, it works really nicely that it has like the little places within that have the rhyming, and then there's the alliteration of like slithering, skin, seeking space to spread, lots of S's throughout this whole thing, and W's. The whistled winds. Those are both letters that create kind of like lengthy sounds that could almost imitate the sound of the feathers or the animal noises that are going on. And so many different words for feathers here, the feathers, the plumage, the and describing the bird as avian, and the fiends from hell. Really great word choices all throughout.
Absolutely. That was just a wonderful comment. I really like the way that you mentioned the W and the S sounds because, yeah, those do. You're right. They sound like the sound of feathers. Excellent comment and observations there. Thank you. And I'd like to welcome Rex to the show. Hey, Rex. Glad you could join us.
Hello.
Good evening. And did you get a chance to read Yorkie Buff's poem?
That second last line, was a little off, odd because it was blank, but it fits as a nice thought to those wings being fully spread in the moment because of what's written on the last line, driven by avian fiends from hell. It offers up that thought. It kind of comes as a dream driven by the fear of the birds or just the darkness itself. So you got stiff things make bone taps, dried into bark strength by scarred whistle winds. Space to spread feathers. There's a kind of a note to hey, darkness hovers quite like the sound of that which bursts outside the window, as well as scratches and taps upon that window. There's almost a poesy in darkness in it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I have to agree. I do like the way that the description of the owl, as you said, really comes across as a description of something even darker. Yeah, I think what I particularly like about this poem is she takes something as beautiful and simple as an owl, and it really makes me think about how we see something so different in the daylight and at nighttime, where if we saw an owl in the daylight, it would be this beautiful and majestic bird, and we see it at nighttime. It can look almost sinister, and I think that can even go for like if you're in your room and you're looking around your room in daylight, everything looks, you know, like it's supposed to. And then when shadows are cast and shapes are changed and rearranged, there's something that really quite eerie that can happen with those. And I like how she just gets kind of progressively darker with this and ends with dark dream hovers driven by avian fiends from hell. It almost gives it a dark mythological type feel to it. So excellent write and very well done. All right. And now, Rex, we're going to go to you. What do you got for us next?
All right. Concerted change, gloss. From thoughts, I weigh down upon joy. And, well, since Daisy did, I guess this one's on you.
All right, sounds good. concerted change by Way Down Upon Joy. And it goes like this. Love at the lips was touched, perhaps like word we crutch, sensational and fine, yet lost with my decline, a scented sort of smudge. Love at the lips was touched, as sweet as I could bear, before this day's nightmare, each moment masking pain, while memories remain. Those times of no compare, as sweet as I could bear, and once they seemed too much, not much was left to clutch, for what was to remain was pure replaced in vain. My love, now life is touch, and once that seemed too much. I lived on air now masked by time's untimely task, and all the sweet now salted brine as heaven looms to undermine, like care that could not last. I lived on air now masked. End poem. Oh my goodness, that is just absolutely beautiful. And your thoughts, Rex?
Kind of brought forward, because this kind of hits on that notion of being continually masked, and there's a melancholy thought to it, and all the sweet now salted brine as heaven's looms to undermine, like care that could not last. I lived on air now masked, and it hits on that notion of not being able to see that which is normality, the thought of looking at those lips, so to speak, because they're always covered now.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. I like how you talk about, you know, looking at what's beneath, what's masked, and, you know, the it really, to me, reflects really well the Robert Frost poem. The one bummer about calling in a little late was the fact that I had so planned for you to read the intro poem, which would have been perfect in your voice. But as I told people, they just had to settle for mine. And so, wonderful comment. And Afasiana, your thoughts?
I really like the language. It has that kind of Robert Frost feeling to it with, by time's untimely task. The lines like that just really have that kind of traditional feel to it. I don't know if traditional is the right word, but it's kind of like the era of Frost that just comes to life for me. Perhaps like worldly crutch, sensational and fine, yet lost with my decline. I don't know, there's a classic feel to this that I really like, even though it has contemporary, elements to it for sure. It has that feeling of really fitting in with the inspiration.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I really like when she does the gloss form, and you're right, it does. It's a nice balance of contemporary and classic, and I really like this all the way through, but I especially like at the beginning where it says, love at the lips was touched, perhaps like worldly crutch, sensational and fine, it lost with my decline. I like the phrase worldly crutch, almost like we lean on other people. It becomes, it almost seems to me a symbolism of a codependent relationship. And then I like I like it all the way through, but I especially also like near the end where it says, I live on air now masked by time's untimely task. As you mentioned, that's really great phrasing there. And, you know, I like the whole idea that we understand and we know that time passes for everyone and eventually we all die, you know, but it just, sometimes it seems like it does not go the way we wanted or the way we planned, you know, and there's a kind of a haunting elegance to this poem. It's beautifully written and very well done. All right, Rex, back to you.
Got Clasped in Death's Arms by Martha Gethmore, and you got a G, an ST for that.
Yes, I do. All right. So let me find that. And here we go.
Clasped in Death's Arms by Martha Gettle. I feel them as I walk the floor. Their pain I feel as never before. The ghosts that live here in this place. The feelings that run through this space. This house, it hurts so bad, you know. Their pain I feel as onward I go. I came here to set them all free, free of all they used to be. I should be here, I know it's true. Along with them in this house I do. Here where the pain flows like wine, here among the tortured minds. We came here for a party, it's true, a way to pass time, something to do. But too much booze and fun in time started messing with our minds. Kissing Bill just once more, suddenly Adele was there as before. She pulled me away, slapped my face, so much rage there in that place. As we began to fight, you know, I could see so many candles glow. She shoved me hard into the wall, then I saw the candles fall. Debris, it began to feed the fire. I saw flames as they leapt higher. Yellow and orange, an eerie sight as screams began to fill the night. I ran, it is true, but what can I say? From the flames I had to get away. It seemed to be so very far. But then at last I reached my car. I climbed inside, I shut the door. I could not watch, not anymore. My friends died that awful night. Now I am here, the wrong to right. I cannot live here, not all alone. With my friends I must go home. So these candles will light the way. With my friends I go today. The candles lit a glowing light. They come from the dark tonight. They surround me here at last, all my friends lost in the past. They touch my skin, gather close, all the ones I miss the most. I'm waiting here in the candle's light. At last I'll join my friends tonight. I feel the flames heat the room. I know death for me is coming soon. I close my eyes, I smile at last. In death's arms, my body's clasped. And poem.
Great reading right there, Martha. Thank you for the SoundCloud. It is very much appreciated. And Afasiana, your thoughts on Martha's poem?
I found it interesting that there's like a warmth in the death clasp at the end. Often death is described as kind of like a cold kind of feeling, but it's like there is this warmth that she's experiencing there at the end, and I think it's because she's ready for it, because she's looking to be reunited with these people, that it's not like the cold grasp of the Grim Reaper. It's a warm, almost hug. So it's a really interesting twist to me, the way that was done. And it was interesting the way that it was all kind of personified, with them thrown up against the wall and the candles falling. And, like, I don't know, there's just something about, like, death having a life of its own in a really interesting way. Cool poem.
Absolutely. I have to agree. And I think you're spot on about the ending, where it's, you know, it's that warmth, because it's somebody welcoming death. It's somebody who's ready to go to their family and friends who have passed on. And yes, absolutely, just some creative personification of death. So excellent comment and observation. And Rex, your thoughts?
The resignation is, in her mind anyway, it's apt because of that which came before. Because there's a serious role of guilt that flows from this, because you got the full remembrance of that singular night, which holds itself like that candle to a brain. are fully endeared within the brain with such clarity that you can roll through the story to the point where now it is time to repay or honor that supposed debt by joining them in the after midnight, so to speak, because she should have been there to begin with.
Absolutely, yeah, and I'm glad you brought up that part about how she talks about the beforehand, that singular day where the fighting happened and the deaths happened, because you know that's the thing is we always remember our last moments with people, and sometimes you know we're racked with guilt depending on if we feel like we weren't loving enough or even if you know, things ended on a sour note, right? So I think that's an extremely important part of the poem that you brought up, because there is then kind of this thought of a rekindling, that a sense of wanting to make things right. And this, as always, has wonderful rhyme and flow. She's such a creative storyteller, and I feel like what she does very well is she brings us characters that we can empathize with, characters who have flaws, who have become angry, who have become sad, who have slapped and kissed, and now face that final comfort of death. So. Just an excellent write all the way through and very well done. And all right, Rex, back to you.
All right, now you have Let Go by E.A. And you have a cloud for that one too.
Yes, we do. And I will go ahead and mosey into there and push play.
Hi, Athea, and in the words of Robert Frost, love at the lips was touch, as sweet as I could bear, and once that seemed too much, I lived on air. And this is my poem, The Let Go. The sun is setting now, behind the mountain there, that once commanded how I ought to stare. The kingfisher is heard. I look out at the limb where oft I've seen that bird and thought of him. The he who has no time to offer me a word but can be seen online for hours. Absurd. To torture my own mind with thoughts of who he meets as if any of them compares, competes. And yet he takes their hand, I know this for a fact, and when he's done, we'll stand, start walking back. To me, whose feelings change with every passing day, he fails to rearrange what I will say.
Wonderful read and write there, Ia. Thank you so much. I hope we get to hear more of her voice. She's got just a wonderful reading voice. And Rex, your thoughts on this poem?
Well, first I'm going to have to remember it's Ia, although I wouldn't have pegged it that way. That's an unusual name. So,
oh, we've all done that. I think we've all called her Ea at some point, and then she reminds us that it's Ia. So.
It's on the first two stanzas being that note of remembrance, sun is setting, mountains, and just looking at the window, so to speak, and hearing that kingfisher off in the distance, that which drags her thoughts back to him. And it is all about betrayal, because everything, it's on that note of feeding his need at the moment and then moving on to the next one. Like that bird plucking that meal out of the sea and then moving on to that next meal, so to speak.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you're right, it's about betrayal. And I like how you refer to it as moving on to the next meal, because there really is that sense of somebody who just uses for no other reason than what temporarily filled whatever need they have at the moment. So excellent comment. And Afasiana, did you get a chance to read Ia's poem, or do you need a little time?
I just got caught up, so I haven't had a lot of time to think about it, but I do want to say that I really enjoyed it, and I like what Rex just said about how there's that selfishness of the bird just going off to be with whoever's going to, or wherever there's going to be the food, and not be loyal to the person who's always there watching, who always is consistently there and thinking of him. I thought the bird worked really nicely as a metaphor here for probably a person in her life. It was just wonderful. And I'm loving that there's so much about the birds in response to these prompts, because I'm not enough of a bird person, but I'm looking up what the birds are so I can picture it too. And beautiful birds.
Right.
So I'm liking that. And as a side note, and I've read much of Ia's poetry and enjoyed it, but I've never heard her voice before. So it's really nice to have a voice to put to the poems that I've read.
It truly is. It really is. And I like that you went with the kestrel. Now, for me, one of my favorite birds is the blue heron. You know, I just think there's something about them. And, of course, like hawks and eagles. What I like about this on a technical level is she does a beautiful job of allowing one stanza to flow to the next. And what I like about it is there's this duality within the poem. There's this idea of the not the heron, I was just talking about them, but the kestrel, you know, flying off and leaving her alone. But then, as it says, the he who has no time to offer me a word but can be seen online for hours observed. You know, it really, and then within those lines, you feel like you see this kind of idea of somebody that is either a long-distance relationship or friendship, and this idea of just feeling hurt and the person moving on. And it's a wonderful emotive write with another one that has like a delicate and emotional darkness. So I think it's just a wonderful write and very well done. All right. And Rex, what do you got for us next?
Descriptive by Jim Bellamy, which I'll do, I guess. The slippers on the table seem all too real. A road which leads west must seem too cruel. The darkness descends. The night must appear as ruled by red light, as the dead fade tears that fall. And the sun disclaims the gay moon as the blackness of faith constrains this veiled hour of surreal and great times when the lightning scoured. The regimens of pain and the storm and the rain seem vain. Otherwise, the ballast underplayed must strain once again the palest this noon made real. All the barren darkness must enchain the hands of the word. Red whisper spew and break the shred grass that grows on this lawn which seems too real. The night is abroad and the nameless stars white as bright. And fun.
Great read there, Rex. I'm glad you assigned that one to yourself. And Afasiana, your thoughts on Jim's poem?
Well, I really like the beginning of the slippers on the table. That is quite the opening. And then the end there, and the tameless stars. There's something about the sky that cannot be, you know, tamed, that just really feels symbolic and true. You know, there's one of my favorite shows, Firefly. The theme song is "You Can't Take the Sky from Me," and it's like no matter what happens, and you know, you can take everything that I have, or I can be displaced, but I'll always be able to look at the sky. Now, I've learned from my year of forest fires that that's actually not true. I have lost the sky. I'm like, you can't take the sky from me. Oh, yeah, you can. But no, I just love the concept of tameless stars. There's that wildness that nobody can control. It's a wonderful ending.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, and I love your sense of humor. You know, at least the song's partially right, because even if you can't see the sky because of all the smoke, you know it's there. You know, that was a wonderful comment on the whole thought of, you know, the beauty and the power of the sky. So very, very well said. And Rex, you read that wonderfully. Your thoughts?
Well, the title is apt because it is a full description of darkness and the pain within that darkness, sitting, offering up the that which seems all too real in the moment, yet is as it is. Bled whisper spume and rake the shred of grass that grows on this thorn which seems too real. That's a careful night to everything, careful note to everything being sharp-edged, and it kind of offers that sort of being etched upon the mind in the moment as a remembrance that must never be forgot. And the slippers on the table up top give that essence of how lonely it is, because no one feels those slippers anymore.
Right. I like the way you mentioned that about the slippers no longer being used, and how there's a lot of sharp edges in this poem, and the imagery of this poem. I think that was a wonderful observation. And I like how there's something about this that feels so lonely, like the whole idea of going, looking at those unused slippers, looking at those, the blackness of faith, the constraints, this failed hour, surreal and great times where lightning scours the regimens of pain. It feels like the whole idea of pain being faced alone. And there's just really some hard-hitting imagery in this. I'm not sure what an Aldebaran is. I will have to Google that. I like the word, though. I like the way it sounds. Of the word. What's that?
What was that word?
Aldebaran. Aldebaran. And yeah, I like bled whisper spume and rape the shred grass that grows on this lawn. Rape is a really difficult word to read, but I like when it's used in a different context, and the whole idea that the earth itself has been violated. So, you know, I just think this has wonderful use of phrasing and just creative dark imagery all the way through, and very well done. So what did you find out about Aldebaran there, Rex?
Well, it seems to be there's a reference to a scorpion. Okay. There's a reference to survival gear. And there's also a reference to pen and ink, which is Aldebaran pen and ink on arches, by Joanna Gregori. But
wow, quite a lot of quite a few different references. Well, that makes it even more intriguing. I like that. I like that. Very cool. All right.
Well,
now, what do you got?
Also, the star itself.
Oh, it's actually a star?
Yeah, a giant star, about 65 light years from here.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's cool. That's cool. That kind of reminds me of that contest that Rich F. ran with the, the galaxy that was like so many light years away. I like when people use imagery and metaphors from space. I think that's really cool. Well, thank you for looking that up. All right, and what do we got next?
Burn Even Hotter by Julie Buck, and I think Daisy ought to have this one.
Sure. Burned Even Hotter by Julie Buck. I don't need God or famine or plague to punish me. Hurting my own self is my strongest skill. Why sometimes things I truly love I kill. No, my thoughts don't race and my moods don't swing. I simply behave my way, and overall it seems I go against the grain of the sane. Love makes me nervous, and trust worries about its own sincerity. By far, my crazy is still young, and its morphing to full-blown maniacal is not a conventional gentle passage. I don't need the Bible or poverty or disease to punish me. Drawing my own blood is my mightiest truth. And always I am the first to abhor my ways with a stack of questions. Once I heard the devil ask, "Woman, what is your fight?" I shrugged my apathetic shoulders and said, "I have no answer for that." The fires in hell burned even hotter that night. End pull.
Great read there, Aphasiana, just spot on. I have to say, I really like Julie's writing, and I like the way she does this and many of her poems in the first person. I like that this seems to touch on the subject of cutting, but more than, like, self-harm. But more than that, I think what it really touches on for me is the whole idea that we don't need other people or literature or anything to remind us of, you know, our own guilt, our own, we have these ways of replaying our faults, our times we make bad decisions over and over again in our heads. And I really like, I don't need the Bible or poverty or disease to punish me. And always I am the fire to abhor my ways with a stick of questions, like the whole idea of just questioning yourself. And the ending where it says, I have no answer for that, and the fires of hell burned even hotter that night, reminds me of the part in the Bible where it says, you need to either be hot or cold, don't be lukewarm. And I feel like that touches, I don't want to say like it's just a biblical thought, because I think when it comes to any important issues, you have to take a side. You can't be hot or cold, you cannot be lukewarm. You cannot be tepid. Yeah, and so I just think this is a wonderful, thought-provoking write, and very well done, and very just clever and amusing. And Rex, your thoughts?
Why sometimes things I choose love I kill? There is, I remember something, those we love the most we kill, or something along that line, but can't remember where I know that from, but I do know that thought. And it hits on that note of we are our own worst enemies, and hits on two other things in here. The thought to crazy and full-blown maniacal is kind of a gentle passage. Kind of hits me with that thought of do not go gentle into night. Rage against the dying of the light. Do not go gentle into that good night, so to speak. It's the passion of that, which is drawing my own blood is my mightiest truth. It's kind of a note to self-harm, maybe literal as well as metaphorical. It kind of hits on both ends. And the thought with the devil, woman, what is your fight? It kind of hits on that notion of the right shoulder, left shoulder, the devil speaking on one end, yet the other half offers up nothing. So in that moment, the fires in hell burned even hotter that night, runs right back to that thought, drawing my own blood is my mightiest truth. Again, that thought to bringing the pain forth in such a manner that is befitting.
Absolutely. I like that you brought up the idea of how we are our own worst enemies, and how and I do think there are quotes like I can't remember either who said it, but I've heard quotes like that before, with the whole idea of we kill what we love or we kill who we love. And what I think of when I hear that is the whole idea that, like, when you made that comment, I was thinking we really don't necessarily always, like, actually physically kill people we love, but the people we love are and trust the most are the people we lash out at the most, because, you know, those are the ones that we feel safe lashing out at. So I think that was just a wonderful observation there and a great comment. And Afasiana, you read that wonderfully. Your thoughts?
I agree with what both of you are saying about how we end up, you know, hurting the people who we love because they are the ones we feel comfortable lashing out at. You know, also I think when it's someone who you care about, what their opinion is matters more. So if they love you back, there is more potential for pain there, not literal pain, but, you know, for hurt feelings. And I also think that she did a really great job at talking about self-harm. Again, not necessarily physical, although she definitely alludes to that. But, you know, self-sabotage in a way of not letting yourself succeed. She says that love makes her nervous. And I think that's something that a lot of people can relate to. Love is wonderful, but I think it's normal to fear love because that vulnerability does allow you to get hurt. And I liked trust worries about its own sincerity, because that idea of, you know, even when you're trying to be true, you're questioning yourself about, is that what I mean? Is that what I actually feel? Is this, if you're not sure of yourself, then can you be truly honest with other people? I thought this had a lot of depth to it. It was really nice.
Absolutely. And what's that? Oh, Oscar Wilde. Yes. Okay,
each man kills the thing he loves.
Okay. Cool. I'm glad you found that, because, yeah, I knew it sounded familiar. But, yeah, I like that you use the phrase, Faisy, the self-sabotage, and then, you know, talked about, you know, how we all want love, but at the same time we fear it because it means being vulnerable. So that was an excellent comment. All right. So I tell you, if we need any information, we'll just go ahead and send Rex off to, like, Google Land, and he can find it for us.
Well, I knew it. I just couldn't place it, and I added a little bit too much to it. It was shorter. Oscar's, which
right.
Each man cares the thing he loves. So I knew I'd seen it.
Yeah. But you have the general thought. So that's cool. All right, so what do we got next?
Harvest Moon by Mr. N.
All right, and I believe yes, we do. So here we go.
This is my recital of Harvest Moon, a poem inspired by Robert Frost. awakened from my depressive trance by winds that roared in happenstance. The door blew open, if by chance, to give me a truly terrifying glance of the autumnal harbinger's swaying dance. In the ominous nightly breeze, it looked like fire among the trees. The winds die down and the nights advance. The golden red adornments strewn were gently kissed by harvest moon. But my fears began to multiply as the wolves loosed a harrowing cry, and in the light of the lantern's eye, the ravenous hunters encircle their prey. Though tonight will be the night I die, I shan't live to fret another day.
Wonderful reading right there, Mr. M. Thank you for the recording. It is very much appreciated. And he wrote to Bereft by Robert Frost, and he actually tried to do a similar layout and rhyme pattern scheme, and I think he did a great job with that. And Rex, your thoughts?
Well, that's a dark piece by Frost, The Rollover, and it kind of has a thought to the somber darkness of Poe itself. He finishes out with a word I had no left but God. Doesn't fit that, but M hits on that note of going a little deeper with the darkness and actually embalming himself with the thought of kind of Poe, awakened from my depressive trance by winds that roared and happenstance. The door blew open, if by chance, to give me a truly terrifying glance of the autumnal harbinger's swaying dance. There's that nice tone of depressive voice and venue, and still to continue in the ominous nightly breeze. It looked like fire among the trees. There's that notion of seeing that which is rooted deeper beyond the one's own sight, so to speak. And yet, the winds die down and the nights advance. And then kind of get a little gentle note with the harvest moon, but still the fear holds itself true and walks within that note, knowing the darkness comes. And I like that last line, I shan't live to fret another day. It gives that notion of the back end of the raven, so to speak, calling forth, you are mine, and we go home tonight.
Absolutely. And you're right, there. It does have that kind of Poe-like feel, and he does delve deeper into the darkness. And it is really interesting how right in the center is that one line that's just slightly like we're the golden red adornment strewn were gently kissed by harvest moon. It's like that almost that very brief moment of calm and pleasure before being pulled back into that kind of that abyss of darkness. So wonderful observation there, Rex, and great comment. And Afasiana, your thoughts?
I thought it created such a beautiful setting. The autumnal harbinger. Okay. The autumn coming and kind of like, you know, telling us that the end of summer has come and soon it will be the cold winter. It is a harbinger of sense, but it's a dance. It's a beautiful, like, you can picture the red leaves in the trees as it talks about looking like fire and gold-red adornments strewn were gently kissed by the harvest moon. So I'm picturing the leaves so beautiful with just that little glint of moonlight on them. And yet, it's a fearful scene for him as well. But it's just, I don't know, I'm picturing it so beautiful. And the wolves are there, and the sound of their cries are frightening. And yet, I don't know, I'm still thinking it's kind of like an amazing way to go. If that has to be your last night, it's a great view.
Right?
I have like a morbid beauty to it. I I don't know. It sounds amazing to me. And even the I shan't fret, live to fret another day, that's not such a, I don't know, like not having to worry anymore is kind of what he's saying. It's not like, oh, no, I won't get to experience the good things. I shan't live to fret another day. I don't need to worry about anything anymore. I don't know. This had an interesting tone to it. I thought it was beautiful, like almost too beautiful.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Oh, go ahead.
There's that note to Dracula in those wolves. Listen to the wolves. What sweet music they make.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it does have that kind of feel to it. Yeah, and I did like that you brought up the wolves of Faziana because, the imagery and the sound, and you're right, there is something beautiful about this imagery, and there is something almost like how in Martha's poem it was, there's this acceptance of death. There really is this kind of, like, acceptance and this idea of finally being at peace. I like that. I like the idea of the finally being at peace and the way he uses the movement of the leaves and the glow of the moon to create atmosphere. And of course, as always, wonderful rhyme and flow, and then very well done. And what do you got for us next, Rex?
Fishing Buddy by Swan Song. And I take this one again. The look on his face was that of shock, and the rifle that was not supposed to fire did. A bullet went through the plaster wall, just after it went through the chest of his best friend. He stood there looking at his fishing buddy, his classmate since kindergarten. The eyes gazed in shocked surprise, unable to fathom he was dead. Then he collapsed on the floor, blood squirting from a gaping wound with every beat of his fading heart. Soon, a blood soaked into the rug, almost black on a tan shag, the rifle, a gift from his father, who lectured him about guns. He always treated as if they were loaded, and then the prank he was going to pull by breaking the rule just one time on his childhood friend. He did not want to die. The rifle lay on the floor, a sinister sheen on the fade bluing next to a brass shelf ejected at the accidental firing. And boom.
Great read there, Rex. I have to say, this one really hits hard, and I think it's because the darkness is all too real. Like, this could have easily been, on Jeff's part, a made-up story, but we know it's a real story for someone out there. So, just like I said, it hits hard. And Faziana, your thoughts?
I think you just called it there, Pam. It's too real. It hits hard because it can be real, because it has been real. Even if this particular story is not real, it's something that does happen. So this hits, I think, harder than a lot of, like, the more fantasy kind of dark things, because it has that realism to it, and right down to, like, the small details of, like, the sheen on the brass, the shell that's been ejected, and the emphasis again on the last line that it was an accidental firing, that this was not something that was planned, this was not animosity. This is a friend who was lost. And that's just, it's incredibly painful. It's well done, but it's a difficult story to hear.
Absolutely. And you're right, his attention to the small details really added to the right. And the other thing is, I grew up in the middle of the woods most of my childhood, and hunting has always been a big part of life and family. And you know, I, it, like from a very young age,
the gun safety was installed in us. But the thing is things like this happen, even in you know, societies and families where gun safety is taught. But still, I just a brief moment on my soapbox. Gun safety, always, always, always teach gun safety. It is so important.
Right.
Now I'm off of my soapbox. And Rex, your thoughts?
I'm going deliberate. Because when you're taught that early and it's always pounded into you, you don't ever, ever break that rule. But
exactly,
he was going to pull by breaking the rule just one time on his childhood friend who did not want to die. There's that note right there, who did not want to die. So this comes across as a deliberate act, so to speak, something that is maybe a payback for a slight or a bit of jealousy, but something he can also pass off as a hunting act.
Oh, I like that thought. And it kind of delves into the thought of, I watched some of those YouTube videos about serial killers or, you know, dark stuff that happens and, you know, child serial killers. And not that this reads like a serial killer. It really just reads like, you know, as you what I thought of as you were commenting, Rex, on your observation was it's almost like that crime of a passion, like that, like as you mentioned, like that jealousy or that instant rage that just overcomes a person. So, yeah, that's a really different and cool way to look at it. So wonderful comments, both of you. And just a wonderful write here from Jeff. You know, I'm glad we're getting to see more of him, of his writing again. And hopefully sometime he'll be able to call into the shows. All right. And what do you got for us next, Rex?
Silence by Guilty, and this one's on you.
Okie dokie, Smokey. I never realized how much next Rex rhymes and makes me almost stumble over my tongue until I've said it about 10 times in a row. All right. This is Silence by Guilty, and it goes like this. When breath leaves and the belly bloats, vacant eyes stare at the fatal progeny, for their prayers echo in the eardrum of God. He did not grant their respite. The body sliced, amputated, stumped half of what was vital, living, carousing man, withered away accusingly through mortal lenses when living ends. Machines flatline, the sad procession, mournful nurses, well-rehearsed in such affairs, pulled tubes, covered the hollowed face, moved the family along. Doctors are absent, never acknowledge failures. After all, the bill is still due, and tea time is at 2:00. End poem. Oh, and I'm reading comments. Oh, my goodness. You know what? That was one of those writes that had me so lost in my own thoughts. I was just like, you know, dreaming a lot, dreaming. I was like just lost in thoughts and waiting for Rex to start leaving comments. But, yeah, that wasn't going to happen. So, Aphasiana, your thoughts?
I think it's sad. It's that loss that it's hard to wrap your head around, and there's something so kind of cold and awful about a hospital you know, it's not the last thing that you want is like the machines doing that beep of your heart failing and the so many tubes and all the things. I mean, I've spent quite a bit of time in hospitals, and it's an unpleasant thing. And to see someone that you love die there and have to go through the that kind of cold, distant feeling of, like, people having to, you know, unhook them and all of that. And I feel like there's a sense of abandonment here where it's saying that the doctors are absent, not acknowledging their failures. Now, the thing is, I do know quite a few doctors who are very deeply affected by losing patients. So I don't think it's totally fair, but at the same time, it does feel like that sometimes where, you know, they're not there when you want to feel that acknowledgement. You want to feel that that they care, and you want to see that, and sometimes you don't get to see that part. But this really just speaks to that feeling of kind of abandonment, and I think it's talking about abandonment of your spirituality. It's saying, like, you know, there were prayers that were sent to God, and they echoed, and He did not respond, and the doctors weren't able to help, and the nurses are used to this, and they're just going about their routine. And when it's someone that you love, you really want it to be special. You want people to acknowledge that it's a huge deal, because it's a huge deal to you. So there's a lot of emotion in this.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I think it depends on, as far as doctors go, I think it depends on individual experience. And I think there, you know, I've known doctors who are really caring, and they're there, you know, as much as they can be. But then I've also known and heard of people's experiences that are like this one, where the doctors are distant. They care more about getting to tea time. So, you know, it really just, I think, is an individual experience. But I like how you talk about this kind of this loss of faith, and, you know, how difficult it is to be in an environment that's so cold and sterile, and to watch someone you love just fading away. So, excellent comment. And Rex, your thoughts?
Well, there's a kind of more than just one piece. It's a couple of pieces, because that first stanza, when breath leaves and the belly bloats, vacant eyes stare at the failed progeny, for their prayers echo in the eardrum of God. He did not grant their respite. When you look at the thought with belly bloats, that's past the notation of death itself. That's when the body starts decomposing. So that kind of calls to the thought of being out where there is no help, so to speak. And the next one, the body sliced, amputated, stubbed half of what was vital, living, carousing man withered away, accusingly through mortal ends when living ends. Again, that kind of hits on the thought of almost like a field hospital, so to speak. Sliced, amputated. And even with that, he dies anyway. And then you hit the hospital scene, machine flat lying, the sad process, pull the tubes, cut a hollow face, family move along. And in that moment, it's usually the bottom end of this is the doctor is already gone, and the nurse is left to deliver the message, so to speak. Or you already understand, but the doctor doesn't bother offering up any concerted thoughts because of his conceit, which rolls into the thought of money still going to come in, and he's got a golf date.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. That was well said there, Rex. And, yeah, it does almost, like, seem...
Place too much power in the hands of those and give them their godlike status. Yes, they're adorned with riches beyond our dreams, yet there are coals. I understand the coldness. Got to be there in the moment. But the coldness hits in their bedside manner, as well as how they deliver death when they do bother offering up those thoughts to death. And, God, I remember it was almost 50 years ago. I spent 8 hours on an operating table, and the total bill for that whole thing, including 2 days in the hospital, came to $3,000. Today, that 8 hours and having a specialist in there doing his tour of duty, so to speak, would be $100,000 today.
Oh, my goodness. Was that the time your van got hit by another car and you when you were
8 hours getting fish.
Damn. Yeah, well, like I say, we're always fortunate to have you, Rex. But yeah, the cost just really different. And you know, I like how when you mentioned that there's this idea of in the first couple of stanzas of being somewhere where there isn't any help. It almost felt like the whole idea of someone who's to me like a veteran. And there's, you know, I like that it gives that nod to the nurses being there. And there's something just so cold, precise, and horrifying about the phrase machines flatline. This is a poem I admit because it does remind me of my mom's death in the hospital and taking her off the life support. You know, that does hit me hard, and I do personally relate with. It's a powerful and emotive write and very well done. And what do you got for us now, Rex?
Scratching on the Window by Manuel. And that's going to be for Faisy.
You don't have her audio?
No, unfortunately, it couldn't be converted.
Okay, yeah, no problem. I'll read it. I just didn't want to steal her thunder.
No, I remember one of those. I had one of those last week. Yeah, there's something wrong with what she's using to record. It doesn't transfer over.
Okay. Scratching on the Window by Mamya. A hand on the window, fingers scratching the glass, knocking, knocking, knocking on the window glass. Curiosity takes hold of an older sibling, but I knew better and told them, don't go looking. No, stop. Stop walking towards the incessant knocking on the window pane. Do not go near the window pane. Shh and hush, my sibling replied. You're such a baby, she said as I cried. I bet it's just the old tree. How can I tell her? How wrong was she? Step by step, the floorboards creaking. She tried to be quiet, lightly breathing. Her hands reached out to the curtain, and in one whole sweep, we'll finally be certain. Eyes grew wide, and shouts rang out. There was no more doubt. There was a monster outside our window, the dreaded Wendigo. Raised from sleep, our dad came to our room really mad when saw the creature in the window. He carried both of us kids on one go. We woke Mommy, and we all piled in the station wagon and left the cabin. That was the last time we ever went there. Never again. Never, ever. End poem.
Great read there, Afasiana. You can always tell when your librarian skills go into action. It's like your superpower. And, this is just absolutely wonderful storytelling. And Rex, your thoughts?
Step by step, the floorboards creaking. She tried to be quiet, lightly breathing, her hands reaching out to the curtain, and in one whole sweep, we'll finally be certain. It's got a nice ring, the Poe in it, but I was thinking of the a vampire that scratched, because she hits on that notion of don't go to the window, they can't come in unless you offer them the thought of coming in. But she hits on the Wendigo as the nature of this beast that wants into the room, which I thought it was a nice touch.
I thought so too. I like that she went with the Native American legend of the Wendigo. I thought that was a nice touch, and I do like that. And I agree with you that stanza had a wonderful flow to it and a Poe-like feel. So just a great comment. And Afasiana, you read that wonderfully. Your thoughts?
I thought this was great storytelling, and it had, like, the sound of the knocking. That did give me a Poe-like feel with, like, the heart beating under the under the floorboards kind of thing. It had some nice rhymes. It just, the whole thing did flow very well. I liked that it had the sibling kind of conflict of, like, it's not real or is it, and having the dad come in and scoop them both up. I think having it from the child perspective worked really nicely, that first person perspective from a child helped bring the story to life.
Absolutely, yeah. I like when dark, bright stories are told from a child perspective. And what I like about this, as you mentioned, Faisy, that that she uses sound very effectively along with imagery. And that I like that in this, the dad is made the hero. And as you said, the siblings have that little kind of bit of argument and teasing, which I think adds a little bit of relatability. Like, it adds that kind of, even though it's a mythological rite and it's a made-up story, there's a sense of realism to it because you can relate to the idea of looking at your dad as a hero, or at least most, for some people can. And you can relate to the idea of, arguing back and forth with siblings. So it's just a wonderful, creative, dark rite and very well done. You know, I was just thinking, we only have about a half hour left of the show, and we haven't heard Rex do an evil laugh. Do an evil laugh for us, please, Rex.
It's not time.
What?
It's not time.
You're not going to do an evil... You're not going to do an evil laugh for us?
It'll have to wait until it's ripe.
Okay. All right. Well, what's up next?
I got this one, Another Great Depression by Stephen Holland. It all started on a Tuesday at 4 p.m., rain paneling window panes for weeks, houses wind whipped, folks screwed up tight. She squeezes dead roses so hard, thorns pop into her eggshell skin. A polymath token rolls out of his mouth into the soup. She slaps his face with a fish slice. The baby crawls away crying. Jesus hits the marble hearth. Glass shatters. I don't mean anyone no harm, says the judge. Everyone screams as the train smashes into the living room. Even the gluten-free toast tries to make a quick exit out of the kitchen, but it's all too late. The metal monster plays his trump card, yelling, "You little fuckers didn't see this coming!" The mother runs for her baby as the father flies into the roof. A thunderous crack splits the house in two. Giant riveted steel slabs smash through the living room, pulsating everything into tiny splinters. Dark clouds of destruction chase the giant black fist like Apache cheerleaders on fire, plundering its way through a line of white picket fence houses and another. Chimneys obliterate in its path. Bricks and timber flicker out like a deck of cards shuffled by the lungs of a hurricane. Finally, a black metal hulk slams the brick fire station, catapulting the captain. Water gushes skyward. The black beast lets out a deaf, numbing honk and says, "That's what happened in the room." And
perfect. Awesome. Thank you. And Afasiana, your thoughts?
I confess, I'm a little bit confused by what's going on in this poem, but I like the individual bits of it, like the she squeezed dead roses so hard thorns pop into her eggshell skin. That is a really vibrant stanza that I can just imagine. I liked that even the gluten-free toast tries to make a quick exit. And I have to eat gluten-free because of my celiac disease, and let me tell you, gluten-free toast is like a rock, so for it to make a quick exit is impressive.
Right.
This is really interesting. I don't quite follow the plot. I think I don't know the one that it's based on, but it's individually each stanza is super cool. So I'm interested to hear what you two get out of it and help me piece together the bits that I like.
Well, I have to agree that I like the stanzas you brought up. And the gluten-free thing reminds me of a friend of mine who started doing gluten-free for herself and her daughter. And she brought over some bread, and she'd been doing gluten-free at that point for a while. She brought some bread over to my house, and she's like, try this. It tastes just like regular bread. And I took one bite, and I said, when was the last time you had regular bread? This tastes nothing like regular bread.
There are some brands that are okay, but a lot of them not so much.
I have a nephew who's like 27 years old, and he was diagnosed when he was a toddler with wheat allergies. And back then, there was not a whole lot of options. So, yeah, I have to agree, options have gotten much better. But you brought up that she squeezes dead roses so hard thorns pop into her eggshell skin. There's almost like somebody who lashes out at people. To me, that stands a thought that somebody who lashes out at people but then ends up hurting themselves, maybe not physically but emotionally. Like the eggshell skin makes me think of someone who is thin-skinned or somebody like the whole idea of walking on eggshells. Those are the kind of thoughts that I get from that line. But before I make a further comment, of course, I'm sure we're both really interested to see what Rex has to say. So, Rex, your thoughts.
Let me see. It's the blindness of people who refuse to see what is actually happening while the world is torn apart around them, literally. It's a darkness of things that are foreboding and that which is coming. The Great Depression hitting itself right at the top, another Great Depression. There is that sound of the tinkling of glass, the sound of death, the sound of darkness, which will roll heavily across the land, and it walks its way easily into little things. The thought of the train smashing into the living room. There's that cold, hard reality. Oh, shit. It really is coming. The hurricane or tornado thoughts that roll through this is a thought of people losing that which they thought they would have, their livelihoods, their homes as a backdrop, as everything is torn asunder and taken by those who will take.
Yeah, you know, I like that, and I can definitely see that. It does have, like, as you mentioned, that whole thought of, like, they bring up the thought of not seeing the danger that's happening around you until it's too late. So, wonderful observation there. I really like the imagery of dark clouds of destruction chase a giant black fist like Apache cheerleaders on fire, plundering its way through a line of white picket fences, houses, and another. And by mentioning the white picket fence houses, it gives that whole thought of people who have their life in order, who live their life behind the fence, behind the gate, and don't expect anything, you know, bad to ever happen to them. And I like, though, that he ends with, that's what happens when you don't mention the elephant in the room, which kind of gives a turn to the poem. Like the whole idea that, you know, yeah, you could just literally see it being about a hurricane and a storm, you know, something literally happening. But then with those last lines, you can also see it as being how when we try to avoid conversations that need to be had, it can blow up in our faces in a metaphorical and figurative way. So wonderful comments and just a strong write and very well done. All right, Rex, what do we got going on now?
You got The Prisoners by Mark Lupi, and you have a sound pad for that.
All right, let me go ahead, grab that, and here we go.
She told me even love will not be enough. We've been bought and sold. The merchant's life and death counted out the gold for the merchandise. They keep us underneath in the dungeon hold. According to the wise, just one thing is clear. In love, only pain finally will remain. We'll see the stars through the prison bars. There is no defense for your innocence. I still want you near.
Great read and write, Mark. Thank you for the SoundCloud. It is very much appreciated. And Rex, your thoughts on this poem?
Let's see. Well, it can walk in that sort of how love binds two together as a prison cell, so to speak. And even though they're not meant to be, the thought is one keeps the other. But the merchant's life and death count out the goal for the merchandise. They keep us underneath in dungeon hold. There is that notation of elitist values and we being the pennies that are offered for their largesse. And the thought whether we'll see the stars through the prison bars or is that notation of we will always be on the lower end of things because the money is held higher than the thought of us because innocence really has no defense when those who can deem us guilty takes us within their own hands.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. It reminded me of this quote that I read recently when we were looking up serial killer quotes. But I can't. I'm totally blanking out, but it does remind me of the whole idea: those who like have the money have the power. I think that was a wonderful observation there. And Afasiana, your thoughts?
I really liked "We'll see the stars through the prison bars." So it does talk about how love may lead to pain, but even when they're in the prison, they still see the stars. There's still something worth seeing. So I find that to be an interesting part that could be taken a few different ways.
Absolutely. I have to agree. Yeah, I liked that part, too. We'll see the stars through the prison bars. And I also like that line before, according to the wise, just one thing is clear. In love, only pain finally will remain. The whole idea that, you know, you can go through the love, but in the end, you're going to hurt, I think adds to the darkness of the peace. And I also really like the ending, there's no defense for your innocence. I still want you near. It feels almost like it touches on an act of betrayal. I think it's a wonderful brevity and very well done. And what do we got next, Rex?
Drip Drip by Cal Smiles, and that one's for you.
All right. I get to read Cal. Awesome. I wish she could have called in, but, you know, I understand that. All right. And this is Drip Drip by Kel Smiles, and it goes like this. Entering the hospital room with our young son in tow, leaning to kiss his rosy lips, normally a morning greeting, this time somewhat different from the usual morning kisses. On the floor, a puddle spread steadily, dripping from the bed sheets that once were white, now a brackish gore, unsightly. Not bothering with the button by the bedside, called the nurse to quickly check out vital signs, clearing the room of us two, sent for the doctor, whom gave a single signal. This counting blue, cold, red went up and through, rushing to the surgery theater. 7 pints of blood was given. Emergency responses were sent. delivered, alerted dental team. A previous risk had been taken by infusing thinners before they extracted, caused a blood loss which nearly ceased his life. Drip, drip, end poem. Oh my goodness. Well, I have to say that's another one that hits hard. I feel like it's probably going to, well, I feel like it's going to hit everybody hard, but you know what? I'm going to put it on Rex to comment first.
Well, kind of hits on that notion of somebody's screw-up almost cost a life. Sort of a blood thinness hits on that notion of somebody should not have made that error or gone back quickly to judgment with blood thinness, because obviously when you got a, I mean, 7 pints, actually that's the full body load of a kid, actually even a little bit more. But then again, it kind of represents the fact that with 7 pints, there's going to be some bleeding while on the table trying to fix that which was done to begin with. I kind of don't understand the alerted dental team. That doesn't make a bit of sense, because a previous risk had been taken by infusing thinners before they extracted, caused a blood loss. Something had been done with, I guess, at the dentist, and this was a screw-up at the dentist, this led to the emergency room.
Yep. I have to admit, yeah, you're right. I think there's a little bit of holes in the story. Like, the whole story isn't told. You know, like, I'm not really sure, like, how we went from a dentist to hospital, laying in bed. But, you know, I feel like, and I'm glad you touched on the thought of how obviously somebody screwed up. And I admit, I don't 100% know if this is a true story, though the way it's written, it reads like a true story. And I think even with some of the missing details, it offers up one of those terrifying incidences that every parent fears. And you are right, that is, would be a huge amount of blood, and for a child to lose. So, yeah, I think, you know, and it might have been, I don't know, this might have been when she was living in Australia, and maybe they're different, or maybe there was some sort of surgery he was having to do with his mouth. I'm not 100% sure. But
yeah,
those
but,
are just,
I don't understand the thought the blood thin is for dental surgery. That makes no sense.
The blood thinners must have been for something else, you know.
Well,
I thought
the blood thinners were given at the dentist.
No, it seems like you're not supposed to take it before you're going to the dentist. It's like it should have been stopped in recognition of it. I don't think the blood thinners were directly related. It was more like if you're going to have your wisdom teeth out, you got to be careful about, you know, what you've taken beforehand.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Kind of like the whole idea that, this is something you're not supposed to do, and then it happened by accident. Yeah, that makes sense. And great comment, Rex. And Faziana, your thoughts?
Oh, it just, like, it gives me chills, that fear of, like, seeing that pool of blood, like that, ugh, that. It's a tough one to read. The idea of a child going through this and the fear of a parent seeing that is just awful. And that thing when the doctors are panicked, that's when you feel really panicked. Like when they rush you anywhere, that's a big deal because, I don't know, maybe it's just bogged down here, but, like, it took me months to get anyone to pay attention to me when I was really, really, really sick. So when they're, like, when they immediately take you in, that's when you know you're in trouble.
Yep.
It's like, I've had a lot of scans, and then when you have one, and they're like, okay, so now we're going to go in here, I'm like, well, if you haven't taken 4 months to talk to me again, we're in trouble.
So, right.
That it just, the urgency of it just gives me goosebumps in, like, a terrifying way.
Absolutely. I have to agree. There is an urgency to it. It very much, it reminds me of when my son Jaron was burned and we rushed him into the emergency room. It was that same kind, because he had, you know, second and third degree burns on his legs, his genitals, his lower stomach. And he ended up having to spend like 2 months in the hospital and getting skin grafts. And it does have that same, that feeling, urgency, that just horror that you go through in the moment. So, yep, just a excellent write here, Kel, and very well done. All right, so what are we going on to now, Rex?
Mysteries by Arliss D. And Faze, you can have this one, please.
Okay, but what you just said is not what I see. That I see His Majesty by Rich F.
One up.
The one right before that. Yeah. Rex is posting too fast.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right, here we go. Sorry. Mysteries by Arliss. She has been initiated into the deep mysteries of existence. Birth, death, life, death, infinity, death, eternity, death. In the courtyard, I hand her a blue rose, gloriously layered like the bloom of a sun-soaked miracle. Piously, she bows, caught in base relief. Death constitutes the corrupting force that threatens the kingdom of the transcendental ego who safeguards the unity of our world. We are that ego, moving through time, moving with time, immersed in its inexorable flow through the ritualistic readings of the missing words of deepest mystery. End poem.
Great read, Afasiana. I really like Arliss's poetry. This really touches well on the whole cycle of life and death and the ego of humanity. Rex, your thoughts?
All right, she has been initiated. First, death, life, death, infinity, death, eternity, death. All in the same moment. In the courtyard, I hand her a blue rose, gloriously layered like the bloom of a sun-soaked miracle. Piously, she bows, caught in bass belief. That kind of hints at the notion of the death of that which was bared by her in the moment, her baby. The thought was death, the next one, death constitutes the corrupting force that threatens the kingdom. Again, that thought to death. We are that ego moving through time. And the last readings of the missing words of deepest mystery kind of hints at that notion of the final words spoke at the graveside.
I like that. That was a real thorough analysis of that poem. And, I like that you kind of mentioned that there's this kind of finality, like a sense of moving through almost like the layers of death. And so just a great comment. And Faziana, you read that wonderfully. Your thoughts?
I like that it talks about time in multiple ways, like moving through time or moving with time. Those are two very different things. To move through it, as in you're pushing through the wall, or moving with time as if it's a river and you're flowing at the same pace as it. And that you're immersed in its flow. It's just kind of recognizing that there are many different ways to experience time. I thought that was neat. And I also really liked the blue rose. I don't know. I'm kind of obsessed with the color blue. And the idea of, the rose being blue and like a sun-soaked miracle, I thought that was really pretty.
Yeah, I did. That was really cool. And I like that you mentioned that it shows time passing in different ways. And I do like that imagery, and a blue rose gloriously layered, like the bloom of a sun-soaked miracle. Piously she bows, caught in dash relief. Death constitutes the corrupting force that threatens the kingdom of the transcendental ego. I like how this has a mythological feel to it, but at the same time, it kind of has that feeling like that we don't think death will ever take those we love, and yet it does. So just an excellent write and very well done. All right, Rex, what's up now?
His Majesty, the Artisan by Rich F. Stumble, screaming, straining, striving, tearing at our torture chains, chafing, searching for the crimson keys, casually, oh so carelessly tossed over the garden wall, into the bristle bramble, blood red, twisting, tearing, teasing, searing, scratching, thorns beyond. And now, in silence, watch them build the castle walls that segregate and separate, divide and rule, and smash and break us down, bodies lying one by one, rolling in the mud, the incessant, baking, burning sun that boils the blood. The king is in his counting house, keeping score, amassed the royal regal riches, his walls of gold, his golden walls, his torture tally, damnation alley. He builds his walls of interminal, unimaginable, infeasible worldly wealth, infinitely high, stretching upwards as far as the human eye can see to meet the unforgiving sun. He builds his walls over our dead bodies, rides roughshod, this undeserving god, this loyal roustabout, his loyal layabout, subjects, now his objects of desire, his plaything, build my wall, higher and higher, baby. Maybe, just maybe, time to meet, unite as one, the factory manager and the artisan, the laborer farmer, patient partisan, cast off our caustic chafing chains, throw them down to these scorching Sahara, sultifying sands. Raise our voices and our blistered, bloodied hands. And as fast as his armies build and build and build, his thorough fortress fences, ruinous rusted ramparts, sun-baked bricks, perfecting bourgeois dizzy dreams, his wife the queen keeps the wall of unworn shoes, oh so clean. Prophets roll, profiteroles, Sunday afternoon, peaches and cream, proletariat passions, at last, ignited. As fast as his armies, the hunters and the landos, the lords and the ladies of his inestimable estate, build and build and build within the castle gates with their scintillating, fascinating tools of torture, latest state of the art, all golden gleaming in the midday sun. We will stand strong on the other side of the divide with our worn-out, wasted, weary, washed-up, primitive hammers driven by pure, cruel passions. Oi, Poloi, he will destroy. And now we wend our weary way through his royal maze, winds the walls, hedgerows neatly trimmed, yet at the same time overgrown and somewhat menacing. Too tall to see over, holds him in, containing, constraining us, blood's red brambles, tearing at our fetid flesh as we turn this way and that, trying, struggling, striving, finding our way out. Hopelessly lost in this sunset, boldless haze. A sudden wall of grinning, toothless, scarlet skulls, smashed and splintered, bones crunched and crushed. Parisian skull wall walk, the Paris catacombs, barrière d'enfer, in any language, in all of our sensibilities and psychology, slaughter of the innocent. These truly are the gates of hell, torture tombs, and as he builds, we will smash his fortress down, rise up, throw ourselves against his rotten ramparts, wield our worldly weary weapons of mass destruction, shake the foundations of his fickle fortress, heavy heaving, soaring hearts, the grinning, caustic, cunning king and queen, sprawling sycophants on their thrones of oppression and death. our chains fall to the desert floor in the scorching, parching, unforgiving summer sun, and shameless shoots of green and verdant, vital vegetation, reaching out in quiet desperation as the winter storms go in once more. Unkempt garden fences decaying, boulders tossed and tumbled, unemployed, destroyed, no more displaying, null and void, distant neighbors, undivided, finally shaking hands, the fruits of our labors, loyalty and world love, hope that never ends as peace and harmony descend upon this vibrant land. End poem.
Great read there, Rex. I have to say I really appreciate this poem. He actually wrote to the poem Mending Wall by Robert Frost, which wasn't one of our prompts, but since it was one of his poems. And what I like is that Rich said on the contest wall, thanks for introducing me to his poetry. I'm beginning to read his brilliant work now. I love the subtle depth involved. And that's one of my favorite things about doing these shows is, you know, being able to introduce people to poets and artists that they don't know. And what I like about this is there's a real psychological darkness that he creates, not only with his choice of words, but with the fact that he decides to keep the line short, like between one and four words per line, so that there's kind of this almost hurried feeling, this feeling of intense fear, of wanting to escape. And so I just think he's got some wonderful choice of phrasing here, and it's very well done. And Afasiana, your thoughts?
I agree with you that the short lines work well for this. I liked the section that says, protecting bourgeois dizzy dreams, his wife, the queen, keeps her wall of unworn shoes oh so clean. I thought that that was some really clever commentary. And I also liked the prophet role, Sunday afternoon, peaches and cream, proletariat, passions, at last ignited. I thought that was some good wordplay with the prophet roles. This whole thing has a nice kind of like social commentary edge to it. Very nice.
Absolutely. Well said there. And Rex, you read that wonderfully. Your thoughts?
It invites it a whole lot. There's the catacombs in Paris, kind of hints at the French Revolution. Windsor Castle, so bites at the English crown. But also hits on those shoes that never worn. That hits on Eva Perón and the communistic end that ran down there that people finally got rid of. So this hits on all those notes of repressive of authoritarianism and tyranny that rolls from the higher end to the lower end, and is wearing it out as that which is going on now today. As you look all across the world, there are people raising themselves above that which they are born, well, have been thrown into with what's been going on the past 18 months, that they've had enough, and everybody is starting to raise their fist against these individuals who deny themselves nothing but deny everyone else everything.
Absolutely, and you're right, it does touch on the idea of tyranny, and it does have a lot with history in it. And, you know, so just really a wonderful comment, Rex, and a powerful write by Rich. Now, I know you put up a poem by Poetic Creations, but we're going to have that be a carryover. For Saturday's Part Sinner, Part Saint, 12:30 a.m. Eastern U.S. time, Victoria and I will be filling in for Afasiana, but Afasiana has the contest running. So tell us about that, Afasiana.
So it is some images that are half and half faces, like two faces, partly a Disney princess or hero and partly a Disney villain. So it's like the good and the bad becoming one face. And it really is supposed to touch on how we are sometimes our own worst enemy.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. And Rex, Rhythm and Rhyme on Sunday, what do we got going on there?
Before the invasion.
Early 60s.
British music, 1960 to 65. And they all have one thing in common. What is it?
I know that answer. I figured it out in 9 minutes. but I'm looking forward to that show. And so thank you, Rex. Great show. Thank you very much, Afaviana, for calling in. I really appreciate you. Thank you to everyone who wrote for the show, who is listening now or will be listening later. And, of course, thank you to Fill My Eyes, Jean, for everything that she does. And join Fill My Eyes and Company, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time tonight for Open Poetry. All right, everyone. Have a good night.
Good night.